مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
No third path besides these two paths. The path of Satan and the path of Allah. Either the path of tyrant or oppressors or the path of Allah. You people, O teachers and students, adopt this path which the prophets and saints or awliya established before you. We should travel upon this path and move forward. Those people who move away from this path, this divine path, and invite toward other path, or satanic, are Satans, against their nature and against that path toward which their nature is attentive or thoughtful.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're listening to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that he who is doing his duty to please the Lord, God willing, should not expect the affirmation of everyone. Nothing has the confirmation of all. In one of his other speeches, he says that he who follows the truth and works to please God should not mind what others say or have said of him. Now, this is important that when we are doing something, when we are performing some actions, it should be for God only. It should be for the sake of God and not for the sake of people. And if we are performing something, we should not expect people confirming us. Rather, it should be the God, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who will confirm our actions, who will confirm our deeds. Therefore, it is necessary to perform things for the sake of God and for the God. And if we are doing it for the willing of God, for the happiness of God, then obviously we are performing our real duty. And if we are not performing our real duty, then obviously there will be an issue that we will expecting people to confirm what we are doing and what we are not doing. To pay attention to what we are doing, and it should be for the sake of God, because it is God who will give us reward. It is God who will punish people, and it is God who will give us the reward of what we have done in this world. Many people, unfortunately, when they perform something, they look here and there and they expect people to praise them, for example. And this praising is not good, because this praise of people is the praise of people. And the best thing, the best action is that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala praise us, when the awliyaullah praise us, and when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala confirms our actions. Therefore, in this part of his speech, Imam Khomeini says that if you're performing something, do it for the sake of God. Do it for God so that tomorrow when we go and meet God, we will see him in a happy way. We will see him confirming our actions. And if we are doing this for the God, then obviously our actions will in line with the teachings of Islam. It will be in line with the orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we will not do things for the happiness of the people. Rather, we do this for the happiness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
In the limelight.
Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning, not politics, for national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. The article you're about to hear has been written by Nicholas Kristof, a former New York Times opinion columnist. Nicholas Kristof was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor of Oregon this year. The piece is titled, "These Gun Reforms Could Save 15,000 Lives. We Can Achieve Them." Gun enthusiasts protest that now is the time for mourning and not politics. For national grief rather than polarizing debates about firearms. But we're tired of commemorating gun violence in America only with thoughts and prayers. We didn't respond to the 9/11 attacks only with moments of silence, or to Pearl Harbor just with lowered flags and memorial services. No, we resolved to act, even though these were hard challenges with no perfect solutions. Gun policy is likewise complicated and politically vexing, and we're not going to make everyone safe. Still, experts suggest that over time, we plausibly could reduce gun deaths by a third, or 15,000 lives saved annually, with a series of pragmatic limits on firearms and those who can get them. Instead, we're paralyzed in ways that threaten our democracy and our well-being. American children and American teenagers are 57% more likely to die young compared with children and teenagers in other advanced countries. And guns are one important reason. One study found that Americans aged between 15 and 19 are 82 times more likely to be shot dead than similarly aged teenagers in our peer countries. Let's just acknowledge that what we're doing isn't working, and we need new approaches. So what's a way forward? This will be painful for many of my fellow liberals, but I suggest that we work harder to engage centrists, talk about gun safety rather than gun control, and jump into the weeds. Social scientists suggest complexifying an issue to reduce polarization, and sure enough, I find that I can sometimes have productive conversations with gun enthusiasts if we focus on technocratic details. For example, consider the minimum age to buy or possess a gun. The suspects in both the Uvalde, Texas and Buffalo, New York shootings were only 18 years old, and that's not surprising. Americans aged between 18 and 20 account for 4% of the population, but 17% of those known to have committed a murder. In Wyoming, one of the most pro-gun states in America, the minimum age to buy a handgun is 21. Overall, one-third of states limit purchase of a handgun to those who are age 21 or older, according to the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. If we say that teenagers can't buy alcoholic drinks, Isn't it worth having a conversation about whether they should be able to buy Glock 19 handguns and AR-15 style rifles? One study found that 17% of all firearm offenders obtained guns legally, but would not have been able to do so if their state required handgun purchasers to be at least 21. Even more would have been ineligible to buy guns if there had been limits imposed on those with drug and alcohol convictions. That's another conversation to have. We typically don't allow people with felony convictions to possess firearms. And wouldn't it also make sense to bar purchases by someone with a recent misdemeanor conviction for drug or alcohol abuse, for violence, or for stalking? Only 10 states bar people with stalking convictions from buying guns. We know that people going through breakups are particularly at risk to themselves and to their ex-partners. So why not pass red flag laws that allow guns to be removed from someone who is undergoing a mental health crisis or subject to a domestic violence protection order? Even former President Donald Trump has backed red flag laws. What about universal background checks to buy a firearm? Opinion polls suggest that gun owners themselves overwhelmingly favor universal background checks. Yet 22% of firearms are obtained without them. In much of America, there is a more thorough review of people adopting a rescue dog than of those buying assault rifles. And should we really continue to allow people on the no-fly list to buy firearms but not board a plane? These are pragmatic steps that won't eliminate gun violence or avert every shooting incident, but they can make our country a bit safer. And while they will feel flimsy and unsatisfactory to many, they would at least break the paralysis on sensible gun policy. They would indicate that some progress is possible at a time when gun-related deaths have been worsening. Nineteen elementary school children died in the Texas school shooting on Tuesday, 24th of May, along with two teachers. 9 days earlier, six people were shot in a California church, one fatally, and five were shot, two fatally, at a Texas flea market. A day before that, a gunman killed 10 people in a racist attack on black shoppers in Buffalo, New York. When New Zealand experienced a mass shooting in 2019, that country acted in just 26 days to tighten gun laws. But here in America, it has been 56 years since one of the first gun massacres, the University of Texas Tower shooting in 1966, that claimed the lives of 17 people. Yet we know that gun safety is not a hopeless task, because just about every other country manages to do better. The Onion's satirical website regularly responds to mass shootings with the headline, "No way to prevent this," says only nation where this regularly happens. It has a point. The result of our paralysis is that just since 1975, more Americans have died from guns, including suicides, murders and accidents, than in all the wars in United States history, going back to the American Revolution. Is the Second Amendment an obstacle? Perhaps to some degree. But most of us, judges included, recognize that we need some limits on weapons. Few believe that private citizens should be able to possess mortars, or that it's okay for 15-year-old teenagers to buy assault rifles. The practical question is a difficult one of where precisely to draw the lines. The truth is that we're not going to ban guns in the United States any more than we're going to ban alcohol, motorcycles, hunting knives, cigarettes or other products that can be deadly. Screaming maximalist fights about gun control versus the Second Amendment have created a political stalemate as we continue to lose 45,000 lives a year to gun violence. That's 123 lives lost in a single day. This does not happen in other countries. Japan typically loses a single-digit number of people to gun murders in a year. We lost twice that in a single school shooting incident on Tuesday. Whenever I write about guns, I get indignant protests. Cars kill about as many Americans a year as guns do, but you don't ban cars. No, but we do work to make vehicles safer. Auto safety is a boring, non-politicized endeavor driven by engineers that has enabled us to live with dangerous objects, that is cars, and reduce the auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by more than 90% of the population since 1923. Likewise, we have a non-politicized safety process for ladders, swimming pools and toys. 8 pages of federal regulations on ladders, which kill around 100 people a year, with safety campaigns including making March Ladder Safety Month. Why can't we take a similar evidence-based approach to guns, not aiming for mass confiscation, but for reducing the carnage? For example, we require a license to operate a car, so why not a license to buy a gun? That's the law in Massachusetts, which has one of the lowest gun mortality rates in America. And while Massachusetts is a liberal state where one might expect tighter gun laws, permits are also required through a simpler process to buy a handgun in North Carolina. Texas had such a requirement, but last year approved a new law ending the mandate for a license to carry a handgun. Addressing gun violence must also include a strong mental health component, as the military recognizes in its strategy to reduce suicides. Likewise, social programs like Cure Violence and Becoming a Man aren't specifically about guns, but do appear to reduce gun violence. There are many other steps that we can take. Safe storage requirements for firearms keep guns from children and thieves. Some 380,000 guns are stolen annually from private owners in the United States. We need to crack down on ghost guns assembled by the purchaser from parts without a serial number or any background checks. We must curb the next technology, firearms made by 3D printers. Let's be driven by evidence, which means more research. What about voluntary gun buybacks to reduce the pool of 400 million guns already in America? What about warning labels and guns, cautioning that a firearm in the house increases the risk of a gun death? What about a tax on guns to cover some of the external costs of their misuse, just as we tax cigarettes? What about universal background checks to buy ammunition? How about waiting periods or a limit of 2 gun purchases a month per person? How about a crackdown on straw purchasers who equip gangs? America is losing ground to guns. An estimated 18.8 million firearms were sold in the United States last year. The United States already has the highest number of firearms per capita by far. Yemen, in the midst of a civil war, ranked second. American civilians appear to have more assault weapons, the civilian versions, than the United States military has of the automatic version. So spare us the pious calls to avoid politics. Rather, let's supplement thoughts and prayers with concrete steps based on nerdy evidence gathering, based on hard conversations with people we disagree with to reduce gun deaths, so that elementary schools need not be graveyards.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader...
On the news line.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations. U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdullahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
The U.S. has been shocked by another deadly shooting incident. A gunman has shot dead 19 young children and two adults at an elementary school in the U.S. state of Texas. The carnage happened at a school in the city of Uvalde. The gunman has been identified by law enforcement as 18-year-old Salvador Ramos. The teenager is suspected of shooting his grandmother before the rampage. A U.S. Border Patrol official who was nearby when the shooting began rushed into the school and shot and killed the gunman. The shooter was wearing body armor as he carried out the attack. In a speech from the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was sick and tired of responding to mass shootings as he called for gun control. This is the deadliest U.S. school shooting since the 2012 Sandy Hook shooting in Connecticut, in which 20 children and 6 staff were killed. The bloodshed has revived calls for gun control measures in the U.S. School shootings have become recurring emergencies in the U.S. There have already been 27 school shootings this year alone. 26 school shootings were recorded last year. The massacre at Robb Elementary School happened only 10 days since several people were killed in a racially motivated mass shooting in New York. The U.S. has a unique gun culture with the right to possess firearms enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. The United States is the only nation in the world where civilian guns outnumber the people. There are 120 guns for every 100 Americans. No other nation has more civilian guns than people. Americans are estimated to own 393 million of the 857 million civilian guns available, which is around 46% of the world's civilian gun cache. In 2019, the number of U.S. deaths from gun violence was about 4 per 100,000 people. That's 18 times the average rate in other developed countries. Multiple studies show access to guns contributes to higher firearms-related homicide rates. The U.S. recorded the largest number of gun-related suicides in the world every year from 1990 to 2019. And no other developed nation has mass shootings at the same scale or frequency as the U.S. The issue of gun ownership and stricter control on arms has sharply divided the U.S. society. The powerful National Rifle Association is a key player here. The NRA Institute for Legislative Action is its lobbying division. Over its history, the organization has influenced legislation, participated in or initiated lawsuits, and endorsed or opposed various candidates at local, state, and federal levels. The U.S. is deeply divided over the issue of gun control, and events like the Uvalde tragedy do not change the entrenched views. However, there is no sign that Democrats will get any closer to passing tighter gun control legislation. Some Republicans are already accusing them of using this latest school shooting to further their own political objectives.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ebrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Said Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ebrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman, being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and a robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018 when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernise Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, having good behavior versus bad behavior. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of having good behavior versus bad behavior with our neighbors. Islam gives importance to the neighbor, and we know that the rights of the neighbors must be looked after according to the Islamic teachings. On the other hand, there might be some people who say that our neighbors are not good and they do have bad behavior and they deal with their neighbors badly. What is the answer of Islam to this behavior? We can see that Islam says that because they are your neighbors,
you must have a good behavior versus their bad behavior. And you must not answer them the way they are dealing with you. You must answer them in the best way, in the best possible way, or in the decent way, with the decent behavior. And this will change their attitude gradually. In Islam, it is said, "Waj'alni." There is a prayer with Imam Zainul Abidin is saying, and he says, "Waj'alni Allahumma ajzi bil ihsani musi'ahum." Oh Allah, give me this power that whenever they are being evil with me, I'm answering them in the best way, in a good way, and I'm doing a favor to them. وَأُعْرِضُ بِالتَّجَاوُزِ عَنْ ظَالِمِهِمْ. And keep me away from the oppression if they are doing that. So if we are answering them in a good way, in a good manner, in a decent behavior, it can change the behavior of neighbors when they see that all the time, when they're having the bad behavior, they're having a bad attitude towards us, but we are replying in the best way or in a good and decent way, it will change their behavior in relation to the others, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. In today's lesson, we will be talking about the topic of having a good behavior versus the bad behavior of our neighbors. We said that Islam gives importance to the neighbors, and if our neighbors are having a bad behavior, we must deal in a decent way with them. On the other hand, we see that in the Islamic text, it is said that when your neighbors are having a bad behavior with you, you must forgive them. And this forgiving means that we are having a good relation with them. We are having a good behavior. We are answering them in a good way, in the best way possible. And even if they have maybe insulted us, maybe they are having a bad way of dealing with them, they talk us in a bad way, maybe they deal with other neighbors in the same way. So the best thing to do is to answer them in a decent way, and having the good behavior and decent behavior versus the bad behavior. But on the other hand, if we look and see that if we also answer them the way they were dealing with us, then obviously it brings troubles into the life. It brings insecurity in the neighborhood. It brings dispute amongst the neighbors. And therefore, the peace from that place will be gone. And this peace will flee away from that neighborhood. If we want this neighborhood to be the best neighborhood and a peaceful neighborhood, therefore, we need to make sure that even if our neighbor, a specific neighbor, is not having a good relation with others, we must have a good relation with that person so that he will be changed with the passage of time when he realizes that everyone is having a decent behavior except him, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en/call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news.
with the light.
Chilean scientists believe they have found the world's oldest living tree in a lush green forest in the south of the country. The scientists say their study shows an ancient cypress known as the Great Grandfather might have beaten the record for the world's oldest tree by six centuries. The bristlecone pine tree in eastern California is the current record holder with over 4,800 years of age. The scientist who led the study says the sample they extracted and other dating methods suggest that the Chilean cypress with a 4-meter thick trunk is over 5,000 years old.
We could count all the rings, but we know it's not the tree's age. It's an estimation of what we call a minimum age. So for this kind of tree, the scientific challenge is to estimate with science the part that we do not see and that is missing. And that is what we did with the millennial alerce. This method tells us that 80% of all possible growth trajectories give us an age of this living tree greater than 5,000 years. There's only a 20% chance that the tree is younger.
Borichevich is, however, concerned about visitors harming the tree, which is located in the Costero National Park. He says visitors are still able to circle the tree's base, step on its roots, and even take pieces of its bark. The tree is a conifer native to Chile and Argentina and can grow to heights of up to 45 meters.
The world's oldest living man has just turned 113 years and says he is going to be around at least 10 more years. Good for him. Born on May the 27th, 1909 in Venezuela, Juan Vicente Perez Mora is still in pink of his health and memory and does not take medication. He has no trouble recalling his childhood marriage and the names of his siblings, children, and grandchildren. He has 41 grandchildren, by the way. So what is the secret behind a long life? Work hard, rest on holidays, go to bed early, love for God, and always carry him in your heart. The Guinness World Records declared Perez Mora the oldest living person last week. The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscience of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society, who was the organizer of this event, it said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
while they live far from their original habitat. These alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tries to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bears' living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.